I'm Vermont Edition producer Sam Gale Rosen. This podcast has been edited for brevity, and we hope you like it.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Bob Kinzel. Over the past year, I've been speaking with VPR listeners about the remarkable pace of the daily news cycle. And to be upfront about it, a lot of those conversations start with people telling me how they need to take a break. News moves so fast these days, perhaps because there are more instantaneous platforms delivering the stories, many of which turn out to be not very credible. It can be more than a little overwhelming. But today, we're going to slow things down a bit and look back on the big news stories that made headlines in Vermont this year, as told by reporters who took the time to examine them in detail and in some cases broke the stories in the first place. We've got a kind of rolling thunder review of the state's top reporters with us today on Vermont Edition, and we're going to kick things off with Burlington Free Press reporter April McCollum. April, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Now, let's start with the 2018 elections. A really big voter turnout in Vermont, bigger than expected, an historic candidacy, even though the candidate in question was defeated by a fairly wide margin. How do we put into context the run by Christine Hallquist as the Democratic nominee for governor?
Well, I would say, first of all, it was tremendously important for LGBTQ people, not only in Vermont, but across the nation. There seemed to be a lot of interest and enthusiasm about her candidacy, kind of just for what it symbolized, that a transgender woman was able to be a major party nominee for governor. And because of that, there was a lot of national news attention to Vermont in a way that I don't think we would have expected for a normal election, a normal governor's race, especially with an incumbent governor. So it was just interesting to see the national attention to the race because of her identity, but also within Vermont, Christine Hallquist tried very hard to keep the focus on the issues and some of her very technical policy positions. So it's kind of a balancing act between the attention that she was getting because of her identity and the symbolic nature of the symbolic importance of that, and then also she was fighting the whole time to try to keep the message about economic development and things like that.
Yeah, it was really amazing how different the coverage felt right here in Vermont and then outside of Vermont for sure. The other big election story was the gains that were made by Democrats in an already blue-leading state here in Vermont. How successful were the Democrats?
They were quite successful, and more successful than even the governor's campaign manager, Brittany Wilson. She told me after the election it was more than she expected. The Republican losses were more than she expected, and then on the flip side, the Democrats gained more than she expected. The Democrats gained 12 seats in the House, so they're now up to 95 seats out of 150. And if you add in the progressive seats, they are over the two-thirds threshold that they need to be able to put legislation through without having to worry about the governor's veto. So that's a very important symbolic threshold that they met. And Republicans lost 10 seats, so they're now down to 43, which is very weak. It's the weakest that any governor has had to deal with in recent memory.
Yeah, this is one of those things that's looking like it's going to be an even bigger story perhaps going into 2019, because do you think these gains by the Democrats mean we will, in fact, see a lot of veto overrides in the biennium?
It could play out a number of ways. I think a strong possibility is that it won't even get to that point, that the governor will either negotiate early on and try to shape legislation that he knows is moving forward and that has support among Democrats, or that they'll work some agreement out. There may be some veto overrides, but if the Democrats have the numbers, it may not get to that point in the first place.
There was a lot of investigative reporting done by the Free Press on sexual harassment in Vermont state government this past year. What was discovered, April?
Yeah, I looked into sexual harassment within state government, and I looked at all of the settlements that the state has paid out in the last decade for sex discrimination, which is kind of the broader category that includes sexual harassment, as well as other types of discrimination based on sex and gender. And so overall, we found about $1 million have been paid to state employees to settle their claims in the last decade, and that there are certain agencies that have had multiple cases come up again and again. And then we found some interesting things in the settlements as well.
What's remarkable about that reporting is this is what you're referring to here is known as do not darken my door or no rehire clauses mm-hmm. In these sexual harassment claim cases. So these folks were being paid to basically say, I can't say anything about this afterwards. Where did these cases, where did this policy originate?
Yeah, so actually, do not darken my door is not about what you can say after the settlement. It's about whether you can be rehired. So they're able to speak about their cases. In state government, they can't. There's not like a gag order in these settlements. But the agreement in the settlement is that they basically sign away their right to work for the state in the future. And we found four cases of that happening in the last decade. And basically limits. So they sign away their right to either work for the entire state government or for a particular department. The reason that I was told by one of the state's attorneys is that the argument is that this will cut down on conflict in the workplace. So if you had had a complaint in the Department of Corrections, for example, the argument is that maybe the department would not want you to come back in because you might be clashing with some of the same people that you had the disagreement with in the first place. That doesn't really explain why they would ban them from working for all of state government, which is a lot of jobs, thousands of jobs.
Did the people that you talked to express disappointment that even though they were paid here, that they were not able to get another job within state government?
You know, I wasn't able to speak with anybody who signed one of these agreements. I worked hard, but I was not able to reach anybody in these cases. So I more spoke with some advocates and people who've seen these cases go through who were disappointed. They feel like it's punishing the victim for these discrimination cases. And I should mention that under a new law that passed this year in the legislature, these kind of do not darken my door, no rehire clauses are now illegal in settlements of sexual harassment claims. They remain legal for other types of discrimination claims, but for this particular area, we shouldn't see this happening anymore.
Yeah, Governor Phil Scott signed that law in 2018. And what did he say about signing that law? Was he at all surprised about this policy of do not darken my door and no rehire clauses?
You know, I don't know that he knew that. Well, or I don't know that I had heard him say anything about the state having done this in the past. At least I didn't recall hearing that from the governor. I was surprised when I found this. It wasn't something that I had heard discussed in the legislature or in the governor's office, that this had been such a tool in the toolbox of the state. He signed the package of sexual harassment laws as a way to try to help deal with this issue in the wake of Me Too. But this was one of the kind of the pieces of it that didn't get as much attention and that we then decided to dig deeper on.
And again, you're talking about $1 million paid out over how much time?
Over a decade.
Over a decade. Wow. Well, all right. Thank you so much for speaking with us, April. I really appreciate your reporting on this issue, and thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you so much.
And now joining us up next is VPR's Howard Weiss-Tisman. Howard, great to have you back on Vermont Edition.
Hi, Mitch.
You know, this is one of the stories you were following in 2018 that's been pretty big, and it's about Act 46. This is the school consolidation law. Remind us briefly what this law aims to do.
So Act 46 passed in 2015, and it was a way to encourage school boards, school districts to merge all around the state. Schools have been dealing with a declining enrollment, and this was one way to try to kind of look at regions as one education community in a way. And between 2015 and 2017, there was a bunch of voluntary merging, and that's where the districts that were able to merge either went to the voters or did it, and about two-thirds of the state was able to voluntarily merge leading up to this year.
But that leaves us with the rest. So Act 46 has been controversial, to say the least, for those that did not want to voluntarily merge, and I understand that lawsuits are on the way. What's the latest on the legal challenges to forced consolidation?
Right. So the reason why I think this is such a big story this year is that there were two very important deadlines this year. In June, the Secretary of Education put together the statewide plan, and this is where the Secretary looked at the districts that were not able to merge and made a series of recommendations. And then over the next few months, the State Board of Education met. Some of the meetings were very emotional and heated, and they decided one by one Which of these forced mergers will happen. And that led right up to November 30th when the State Board of Education finalized those decisions. Since then, it's funny, there were two lawsuits actually just before I went on the air. A third lawsuit was just filed just an hour ago.
Wow.
The Huntington School District is also challenging Act 46 in the courts. This week, about 30 school districts filed a joint appeal, and earlier the Elmore Morristown Stowe District. So right now there are three court cases challenging Act 46.
And this is uncharted territory, right? I mean, it's very hard to read the tea leaves here and see how these lawsuits are going to come out.
It is. And what's really fascinating is that all these school boards are right now right in the middle of their budget writing process. So they need to finish their budgets in January to get them done in time to be printed for the town plans and voted on at town meeting, of course. And so it's really uncertain if they should be writing their independent budgets or if they should be writing their new budgets. For some of these school districts that were just forced to merge over the past month or so, they're only finding out, you know, literally over the past few weeks that they now have to write a new budget with the nearby districts. So what's going to happen probably within the next few weeks is we're going to see if a judge is going to put an injunction on this and a stay and try to slow things down. If that doesn't happen, I'm not sure what's going to happen. There are some districts that are really holding out and refusing to work with their neighbors. A few of the other districts I spoke to said they're kind of putting two budgets together in case they are going to have to merge together. So as you said at the top of this program, this was a big story in 2018, and it's certainly going to spill over into 2019.
And as you mentioned, Howard, an emotional one. I mean, this is really about local control and the feelings, I think, in smaller school districts and smaller towns that folks don't want to lose control of their school and the sort of a way of life. Is that fair to say?
They feel very strongly about it. And it is also fair to say that for many of the districts who are fighting this, they are the smaller districts in the state with the smaller towns, declining enrollment. And even though the Agency of Education, the State Board of Education, has said time and time again that Act 46 is not about closing small schools, the smaller schools still feel like if they're just one vote on an 8 or 9 member board, that it's just going to be very hard for them to have their voice heard. And so there are a lot of emotions about this running throughout the state.
Another big story in 2018 and one that you've been following is Vermont's legalization of recreational marijuana. But unlike neighboring Maine and Massachusetts and now the whole country of Canada, Vermonters are in a bit of a catch-22 when it comes to actually purchasing pot legally, right?
That's right. This was a big story this year. As you remember, last year, lawmakers tried to get a cannabis bill together. The governor vetoed it, and right at the start of this year's legislative session, they were able to kind of put together a watered-down version, which legalized the possession of cannabis. People aged 21 and older are now able to possess, announce, and grow a few plants, but it did not set up a tax and regulate system. So it's still illegal to purchase and sell cannabis, marijuana, and like a lot of these stories we're talking about, you know, it's moving in real time. So just this week, the governor's commission put out its report that kind of sets the stage for what's going to be happening next year with the legalization of marijuana in Vermont.
Well, referring to that Marijuana Commission advisory report studying this issue, what did the commission recommend regarding a potential tax and regulate system, and what was left out of their report?
Yeah, there was a lot in there. One of the things they did recommend is a relatively high tax. I think it was a 26 or 27% tax on top of whatever it's going to cost for the weed. And that's higher than Massachusetts. And they also said they are recommending not moving ahead unless there's a reliable way to test drivers. And this has a lot of people scratching their heads because there is not a reliable way to test drivers. There's saliva tests. And I did a story earlier this year on the drug recognition experts, which are the people who work for the Vermont State Police, who now kind of go through a bunch of ways of seeing if people are impaired. And what's interesting, it's like when you have a DUI, blood alcohol content could be measured, and there's an understanding of what impairment is. But even if you test THC in saliva, there just hasn't been science behind what exactly it means to be impaired on cannabis. So another thing to point out is that this commission report is just a series of recommendations. So we're going to have to see what lawmakers do with it. As April mentioned, the governor has a lot less veto power this year. So if lawmakers are able to put a bill together that both houses can agree on, we'll see. We'll see where it goes.
Yeah, and that issue of testing for driver impairment is something that Governor Phil Scott has been very adamant about. That was his main objection, I think, to the whole marijuana issue to begin with. But as you say, there are a lot of complications with really testing for THC. Howard, another story that's been really the big one in Vermont for a while now, and it's no secret that Vermont is one of the oldest populations among U.S. states. But there was news this year of the effect that it's having on emergency service providers. What are the concerns there?
Yeah, well, this is an interesting thread. I looked over the stories I wrote this year, and as you mentioned, I did a story on the Putney Fire Department that's having trouble finding volunteers because there are not enough young people. I did a story on a fuel dealer in Bellows Falls who can't find drivers because there are not enough young people here. We did some stories on Vermont Law School, Marlboro College, Castleton College that are all facing declining enrollments. And, of course, a lot of what we're talking about with Act 46 has to do with the fact that Vermont is aging. So I think this is one of the more fascinating and evolving stories. It's something that's been coming a long time. Economists and Joint Fiscal Office has been looking at it. But it really feels in a lot of ways it's coming to a head. It's slowing down economic growth. Older people just don't make as much money as younger people. So it affects the whole economy in the state. Governor Scott, of course, has tried a few initiatives to get people to move here, to stay and stay program and offer $10,000 to do some remote work. So it's another story that's certainly going to play out in the coming year.
Yeah, another one to look forward to in 2019. BPR's Howard Wise-Tisman, thank you so much for joining us today, Howard.
You're welcome, Mitch.
I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Bob Kinzel. This is Vermont Edition. We're nearing the end of 2018, so it's a good time to turn our gaze back over the year that was in Vermont. We're talking today with some of the state's top reporters about their stories. And our next guest is Paul Heinz. He's the political editor at 7 Days. Paul, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Hey, Mitch. Thanks for having me.
Sure. And one of the biggest stories that you were covering this year had to do with a change in Vermont's gun laws. Now, you reported that 2018 was hardly the first time lawmakers had pushed for a change to gun laws. What had happened previously that did not work out?
Well, this has obviously been an issue that's been discussed at some length for years and years, decades even. I started covering the issue right after the Newtown shootings about 5 years ago. And, you know, what's remarkable to me is that while the Vermont's federal delegation changed its views on guns then and became quite active and in favor of a variety of gun control measures, we did not see that kind of action at the Vermont State House. Back then, of course, Democrats controlled the governorship and the House and the Senate, and yet they were very resistant to take action. But what happened this year, of course, was that right after the Parkland shooting in Florida, we had a near miss here in Vermont. There was a attempted or threatened shooting in Fairhaven, and that prompted Governor Phil Scott to just radically change his own view on gun laws and say that we needed to have some. And so he created an opening for the Democratic House and Senate to pass some pretty strong new gun laws. And within the course of just 2 months, Vermont went from having some of the weakest gun laws in the country to among the strongest. You don't see that kind of action around here like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, really remarkable. And I'd be remiss if I didn't point out that our own podcast here called Jolted delved deeply into that issue about those changing gun laws because of that school shooting that did not happen. Urge folks to check that out. Paul, do you think that perhaps some of the reason that there wasn't action after Newtown, even though, again, as you mentioned, the Democratic majorities that Vermont had here, here and that seems like something could have passed has to do with the strong culture of Vermonters having guns in Vermont. You know, it's something that generations of people have had here, and it's a way of life.
Absolutely. We have a very strong hunting culture here. Many legislators, the last governor and the current governor, both hunters, and it's something that I think Vermonters really value. So I think there is some fear among hunters that, new laws like this could erode their rights. It should be noted that there are a lot of hunters in Vermont who do agree with these new laws and have in favor of this sort of action for some time. I think another issue here is sort of the perceived might of the pro-gun lobby. And I think that there's sort of this lingering notion in Vermont, or at least there was up until this election, that gun control, the gun rights advocates were maybe the silent majority. They certainly could punish you in elections. And so I think that there were a lot of legislators and perhaps others in Vermont who were afraid to do anything because they worried they would be punished at the ballot box.
Well, that's very interesting because there were some who wondered whether Republican Governor Phil Scott would pay a political price for signing that gun control legislation that you talked about. But in the end, it did not hurt his reelection bid. Is there a possibility, though, that further changes could be proposed regarding things like waiting periods for gun purchases as we move ahead into the next year?
Well, right. And not only did it not hurt Governor Scott, but Democrats, as April noted earlier in this program, Democrats picked up seats this time around. So there was not a big backlash that some people thought might happen. I think it'll be really interesting to see if the legislature goes even further this time around. It's just recently Senator Phil Baruth, who's been a longtime supporter of gun laws, he said that he would sponsor yet another package of gun laws this coming legislative session, one of which would require a 48-hour waiting period before somebody could purchase a gun. The other provisions would ban 3D printing of guns, and it would also require the safe storage of weapons. He brought this up in the context of a young man from Essex whose parents say he shot himself with a gun that he had just bought a couple hours earlier. So this family has been advocating for a waiting period, and Senator Baruth wants to make that happen. I'll be curious to see whether the legislature has the appetite to touch this subject again. My instinct is that they won't. That probably neither the legislature nor the governor want to get back into this fight. But if we had made predictions a year ago about gun legislation, we would have been totally wrong about those. So anything could happen.
Yeah, that's a good point. Let's change gears a little bit, Paul. I want to talk about something else here. You've not been shy about pressing Senator Bernie Sanders on whether he will make another bid for president, as he did in 2016. Now, he's done his best to kind of dodge that question. But based on what you've been looking at, do you think Senator Sanders will run for the White House again in 2020?
Yes, I think it's almost certain that he will. And to be clear, he has not said that. He has said that he is considering it and that he is first. He wants to determine whether he is the best person to run against President Trump and to defeat Trump. But I've done some reporting around this that suggests that his aides have been setting up a presidential campaign for him. They're well into the interviewing process. He's done all of the things that a presidential candidate would do to get prepared. Of course, that does not mean that he'll run. But I think if he says yes, they will be ready to roll out a campaign almost instantly. And I would expect a decision one way or the other very early next year. There are a lot of other progressive candidates, some of whom were endorsed Senator Sanders 4 years ago, who are considering running for president themselves now, and they are eager to hear his decision.
Well, let's take a look at what's changed a little bit for Bernie Sanders. I mean, he's far better known now nationally than he was when he started to run in 2016. And, you know, part of the perceived problem of why he didn't win the Democratic nomination was that he wasn't well known in some parts of the country, especially down south, places like that. What are some potential stumbling blocks, though, for the senator if he does run this time around?
Well, first, if I could focus on the things he has going for him, not only does he have that huge name recognition, which he did not have at the beginning of last year's presidential primary. But he has the proven ability to raise a ton of money, and he has a list of donors that is ready to go. And that cannot be discounted. You know, I think another factor here in his favor is last time around, there were very few candidates, and that actually helped him last time because he was one of the only sort of alternatives to Hillary Clinton. This time around, it's the exact opposite, but it still helps him. There's this enormous field of literally dozens of Democrats who are considering running. And in a really fractured and divided field, I think anybody who has high name recognition and an ability to raise money is at a much greater advantage. And this time around, that is him. To answer your actual question, I think some of the challenges that he'll face are demographic. He is a white male who is not a spring chicken. And I think that is could be problematic in the 2020 election, when I think a lot of Democrats will want to see a woman and or person of color and or someone who's quite a bit younger running. And I think, you know, there will be some people who say that we need to move past the 2016 election and we need to see some fresh faces. That's not him. But, you know, I would not discount the strengths that he brings to this race, for sure.
It's going to be fascinating to see. Paul Hines, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Mitch. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. Paul Hines is the political editor at 7 Days. We're going to get to Jasper Craven in just a moment, but first let's take a call. Suzanne is on the line from Verscher. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Absolutely. Thanks for being with us today.
Well, thank you for carrying on with this good program.
And what was your big story for the year, do you think?
Oh, there's so many. But the one that I think I feel most strong about is that I regretted that Governor Scott signed the marijuana bill. I question the not only the usefulness of recreational or the concept of recreational marijuana. I'm starting to think we should criminalize recreation, giving all the damage that we're doing in the woods and everywhere. But anyway, I don't understand why this was embarked upon without a complete spectrum understanding of the pressures on law enforcement, on EMTs, on all sorts of things, and the inability to come up with the lack of a clear assessment of someone's level of inebriation.
So I assume, Suzanne, that you're with the governor on this one, that you really don't want to see a tax and regulate system go forward, at the very least, until there's some kind of test for driver impairment.
Yeah, and I just don't understand why, with the problems that we have, why we would want to add to it in this, what I perceive to be a very enormous way.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Suzanne, thank you very much for the call. I really appreciate it. We are talking about the big news stories of 2018. And now we're going to speak with VT Digger investigative reporter Jasper Craven, who wrote a series of articles that looked into allegations of abuses of power at the Vermont National Guard. Jasper, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thanks so much, Mitch.
You and I spoke not too long ago about your series of reports on sexual misconduct allegations, heavy drinking binges among some members of the Vermont Guard. Remind us briefly of what your series revealed.
Our six-month investigation revealed a number of troubling allegations against senior leaders of the Guard. Essentially, what we found was a good old boys club that existed in the top, comprised essentially of pilots and senior male officers. And for these officials, there existed often impunity for their actions. So we documented an instance where the former wing commander took an F-16 for a work conference in Washington that doubled as a romantic rendezvous. We detailed an F-16 pilot in Djibouti who went off base to unauthorized locations on multiple evenings. We spoke to more than 10 current and former female guard members who detailed serious sexual misconduct allegations, everyday sexual harassment, you know, lewd comments, that sort of thing. And we also wrote a story about a longtime sort of routine process of delaying the discharges of Guard members, which led to them not seeing access to VA pension and other retirement benefits in a timely manner.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. And in fact, this series really had an impact to the point that now the legislature is getting involved. What's happened since these reports came out?
So since the reports came out, a number of state lawmakers have begun looking into potential reforms at the Guard. The Vermont National Guard is a tricky institution in that both the Department of Defense, the governor, and state legislature sort of have some oversight and investigatory powers, but it's sort of unclear how they all work together. So lawmakers are currently studying statutes and figuring out how to best bring transparency and more oversight on the state level. But what seems clear is that the impending election of a new adjutant general will feature some pretty tough questions about the current culture at the Guard, how it can be fixed. Lawmakers are also expected to hold hearings in the House and Senate in which Guard members are expected to testify. Lawmakers are also reaching out to Guard members in hopes of eliciting suggestions of how the Guard can be remedied.
Well, you just mentioned that other shoe that's dropping in this story, and that's the news that Major General Stephen Cray would not seek another term next year as the state's adjutant general for the Guard. And whoever tries to succeed him will need to be approved by lawmakers in Montpelier. Given the baggage dating back a number of years on these allegations, is it more likely, do you think, that a candidate would have to be someone not affiliated of late with the Vermont Guard?
Well, it's certainly unclear where lawmakers are leaning. It's very early in the process. I think so far there have been two announced candidates to succeed Adjutant General Cray. Both are from within the Vermont National Guard. One is on the Army side. The other comes from the Air side. And so certainly the next Adjutant General could be a military official from out of state. Some folks have suggested to me that that's a good idea. I don't know if lawmakers are considering that. It seems as if it will likely be an official with ties to the Vermont Guard. But I think that, yes, whoever, puts their name in the ring will have to answer some hard questions and bring forth some substantive proposals on how to change things.
Jasper, is there any indication that these allegations might affect the planned basing of F-35s at the Burlington International Airport next year?
I think that these allegations likely won't impact those plans. Guard officials remain confident that the F-35s will come to Burlington next September. 18 of the planes are scheduled to be based at the Vermont National Guard, and this will be the first basing of F-35s at a National Guard base in the country. The decision was made many years ago following an environmental review process. I do know that some of the sort of protesters and advocates against the F-35 are angered by these reports and may be considering sort of a new angle in their push against the planes. However, I don't think there's really any precedent for a planned basing to be halted due to these sorts of allegations.
Jasper Craven, investigative reporter for VT Digger, discussing what's happened since his series on the Vermont National Guard was released just a few weeks ago. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jasper.
Thanks a lot, Mitch.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Bob Kinzel. News followers were not disappointed in 2018 if you're a news junkie. Nationally, the Kavanaugh hearings captivated the attention of the nation, and it seems there's breaking news on an almost daily basis coming out of Washington, D.C. But Vermont also had a lot to talk about. We've already heard about the elections, marijuana legalization, school consolidation, trouble at the Vermont National Guard, and gun legislation. We're turning now to VPR's John Dillon, senior reporter for VPR and the New England News Collaborative. John, thanks so much for being with us today.
Hello, Mitch.
You know, John, there have always been challenges for dairy farmers in Vermont. That's nothing new. But you reported this year on an especially hard year for Vermont farmers. How bad are things now? And are we looking at a potential loss of dairy farming as an integral part of the Vermont economy?
You know, I think this was one of those slow-moving crises that really just kind of crept up on us. It's the fourth year of low prices for dairy farmers, but there really was a spiral starting in the spring of farms going out of business. And the total tally this year is 63 farms so far in 2018 did go out of business, about 8.3%. We're down to 699 farms, dairy farms, which is really huge. It changes the way the state looks. It's a big part of our economy, our rural economy. There's a critical mass that's lost when farms leave the area and equipment dealers no longer have their customer base, the feed dealers no longer have theirs, and the whole network sort of collapses. And, you know, maybe we didn't – a number of years ago, many years ago before I got on the scene, there was a big crisis in dairy when technological changes happened where the bulk tank came in and a lot of small dairy farms, thousands of them actually in Vermont, went out of business. I have a sense we're getting to that point, not in terms of numbers, but it was a very pivotal year for the dairy industry in Vermont, and it just was heartbreaking to talk to some of these farmers who don't want to, you know, this is what they do. This is what they love to do. And I went up to Canada with a group of them, and they were looking at the system of supply management up there, and one guy was in tears talking to a Canadian farmer just across the border who was able to paint his barn and you know, pay his help and really, you know, have a good income and maybe take a week off. It's a heartrending story that really did change this year in terms of the critical mass of farmers leaving.
I recall that story you did going up to Canada, but I do wonder, John, if there is a little bit of hope for Vermont dairy farmers in that context, because there is this new NAFTA agreement now, and it's dealing with some of those price controls they have in Canada. Is there an opening here for Vermont farmers to sell some of their milk in Canada and Quebec, especially where they couldn't before?
You know, there's an opening, but it's, I think, a very small one because the Canadian demand and the Canadian production is less than the state of Wisconsin. So it's not like Vermont milk is going to, you know, all of a sudden, or New England milk, the increased sales. And what happened in the new NAFTA is that the some of the export barriers were lowered to U.S. dairy products. So there'll be an increase of U.S. dairy product sales in Canada. But like I said, the market there just isn't big enough to lift all the struggling farms off the floor. And kind of perversely or conversely, the reaction in Canada to that was outrage. You know, they have this supply management system that's based in part on import controls. They believe, as a matter of trade policy, or they believed, that farms should be kept in business through supply management and controls on the food supply from other nations. That, you know, you recall President Trump really wanted that part of the deal. It happened. And when I went up there in October, and there was a massive protest. Trudeau, the Prime Minister Trudeau, you know, hanging an effigy. They're really angry about it. And so the concern is that what may be slightly good for U.S. farmers will be disastrous for their Canadian counterparts.
Another story you've been following very closely that's tied to this, John, is that modern dairy farming in Vermont is dependent on migrant farm workers now, many of whom are undocumented immigrants. Has Immigration, Customs and Enforcement, or ICE, been affecting the ability of those workers to stay in Vermont and do those jobs?
It's affected their security in the sense of there was an increase in 2017, and I don't know the numbers yet in full for 2018, in deportations in sort of the tri-state region. They call it the Swanton sector. So it's Vermont, New Hampshire, and northeastern New York. So there are more people deported, more people picked up. And what that means is that the labor force that supports the Vermont dairy industry is just really, really, really nervous. The other thing that happened is that there are allegations, and it certainly looks to be true in a lawsuit, that some of the license applications, Vermont dairy farm workers are allowed under a bill that passed in 2013 to get a Vermont driver's privilege card. Some of their information was transferred from DMV to ICE, in particular some of the activists who have been public on this issue of better wages for migrant workers were picked up, and the allegation is that they were in fact targeted. So there's a general – I was at an event down in Middlebury the other week, and there's just a general nervousness. You know, people are afraid that their pictures are going to be taken, that their names are going to be turned over, and certainly the farmers are worried that they'll lose their workforce.
There was one victory for migrant farm workers in connection with the iconic ice cream maker Ben & Jerry's. What happened there?
Yeah, they've been working with Ben & Jerry's on what they call a Milk with Dignity program. And under this, they did get an agreement. I think 60-something farms that supply Ben & Jerry's have now agreed to pay minimum wage, at least minimum wage, and meet housing standards, sort of labor safety standards, and a week off during the year. So sort of bringing those working conditions in line with what the rest of the state enjoys. So in exchange for that, and the farmers get paid a little more for that, then worker conditions supposedly will improve. And that was a victory that Migrant Justice, this group that represents the farm workers, did achieve with Ben & Jerry's.
Let's see if you can leave us with some more hope for the new year, John. You reported in 2018 on some good news regarding acid rain's effect on spruce trees. What did you find?
Well, this is one of those stories where it looked like total disaster in the 1980s. Literally dead and dying spruce trees on the top of our mountains were the poster child for acid rain pollution. It's a complex chemistry reaction that happens, but basically it takes a big nutrient out of the soil, calcium, and it causes the spruce trees to be more vulnerable to very cold temperatures in the winter. Acid rain's been declining thanks to the 1990 amendments to the Clean Air Act, and the spruce trees, they noticed there was a big study all over New England of spruce tree growth, and they're recovering. They're much healthier. I hiked up a mountain with two of the researchers. Spruce trees are green and growing. So it was sort of what these scientists were saying is, hey, you know, environmental regulation does actually make a difference in the natural landscape. When you limit pollution, you'll see an impact.
About 30 seconds, John. There's also some conservation efforts that have been successful. Is that right?
Yeah, in Newport, the Land Trust worked with local residents to secure property for a lakeshore bike path, rec path, and then some conservation groups have been working to secure, set aside and protect forests, and then use that growing timber in a California carbon market. So they sequester carbon from the atmosphere, bad for the greenhouse, or bad, you know, big greenhouse gas. And now people will pay for these trees to grow and store that carbon in the forests that are protected. So that was a really interesting story to go out and report.
VPR's John Dillon. Thank you so much, John.
You're welcome, Mitch.